Before we start this episode, we have a quick message from our sponsors.
If you're studying for the Foreign Service Officer test like us, we have a great study tool for you.
Besides listening to our podcast, we also use FSO Compass.
On FSO Compass, you can find practice tests for every section, comprehensive courses that guide you through the entire application process, and you can even connect with other aspiring U.S. diplomats.
The resources have really helped us prepare, and we hope they help you too. To access FSO Compass and get 10% off your annual subscription, be sure to use the link in our description box.
Good luck! Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of How Did We Not Know That? I'm Nat.
I'm Jack.
Happy New Year, everyone. This is our first episode of the new year, and Jack has a very exciting topic for us. What are you going to be talking about today?
Well, I feel a little late to the party on this, but there's been a lot of news around Roe v. Wade.
Ooh.
And so what better way to start the new year than to address what Roe v. Wade is? This past month, we've had quite a few U.S. Supreme Court hearings that directly challenge a woman's right to have an abortion that was set in a previous landmark case known as Roe v. Wade. So we're going to go into the current hearings and the situation in the United States at the end, but today we're just going to really focus on the story behind Roe v. Wade and what the ruling was in the original Supreme Court case. Mm. If anyone's new here, we start each episode with a question, or we try to. So our question for this episode is, as of today, which the time we're recording this, it's January 13th, 2022, what are a woman's rights to abortion in the United States, and when can the state step in and regulate your abortion?
Okay, isn't it like you're allowed to get an abortion within the first like 3 months of your pregnancy, and then like if you need to get it one later, then it's like only if it's like for medical, like health reasons. I don't know. That's my guess.
It's a good guess. We'll see what's happening at the end.
Okay. Whoa. Okay.
To start, we're going to define abortion. In case anyone doesn't know, an abortion is the deliberate termination of a human pregnancy. And this is most often performed during the first 28 weeks of pregnancy. So, a side note on abortion before Roe v. Wade in the United States. Before the late 19th century, abortion was actually legal in the United States before a woman could first feel the movements of the fetus. So that's around 4 months of pregnancy. Yes. So early regulations related to abortion were enacted in the 1820s and 1830s, and it dealt with the sale of dangerous drugs that women used to induce abortions because these would sometimes kill women. So that's when we start to see regulations getting put on abortion, and that's because the drugs that women would take could kill them.
Oh my God.
So it's not safe. And then in the late 1850s, the newly established American Medical Association started to call for the criminalization of abortion, partly in an effort to eliminate doctor competitors, such as midwives and homeopaths, which a homeopath is someone who practices alternative medicine. And so this is because if you're seeking an abortion and it's criminalized, then you can only go to a licensed medical professional.
Are these doctors, do they have to be, like, certified or, like, specially trained to perform abortion? Like, is that why they did it? So then you're getting it from, like, a certified professional? Or was it just to give doctors more business?
I'm not sure. It could be. It could be part out of concern for women's health, but also part for business as well. So it's up in the air. There's not a lot of research on that. And then lastly, another reason that they wanted to criminalize abortion is because during this time, others were alarmed by the country's growing population of immigrants. So they would be anti-abortion because they feared declining birth rates among white American-born Protestant women.
Okay.
Yeah. And so
gotcha.
Later, yeah. Side note. And then later in 1869, the Catholic Church banned abortion at any stage of pregnancy. So even starting at conception, it's banned. And later on in 1873, Congress passes the Comstock Law, which made it illegal to distribute contraceptives and abortion-inducing drugs through the U.S. mail. So that makes it...
Wow. Contraceptives, too.
Yeah. That's the thing. So we'll see that it's not just abortion, but contraceptives have been a part of the narrative around this issue.
Interesting. So kind of like you mentioned this about, like, that it was geared towards, like, white women. So because, like, this is making me think back to our past episodes when we talked about, like, forced sterilization. So, like, at the same time, they're performing abortions on people without their consent, but then, on the other hand, white women, they don't want them to get abortions because they want their population to increase. So.
Yes, an excellent point, Nat. Everybody, you should check out, in season one, our first guest episode, we did a two-part series on the history of forced sterilization in the United States. We will link the two episodes below, so please be sure to check those out. Nat brings up a great point that the way they're addressing women's birth rates is different depending on the color of your skin. So then, by the 1880s, abortion was outlawed across most of the country. So let's fast forward to the story of Roe v. Wade. So in 1969, a 22-year-old woman named Norma McCorvey from Texas was looking to terminate an unwanted pregnancy. Norma was unmarried, unemployed, and had grown up in difficult, impoverished circumstances. So she had already previously given birth twice and given both of those children up for adoption. But during this time of her pregnancy, she wanted to have an abortion. However, during the time of her pregnancy in 1969, abortion was illegal in Texas in all cases unless for the purpose of saving a woman's life. So she could not legally get an abortion in Texas. And also during this time, 30 states in the United States made abortion completely illegal, with only 16 making it legal in cases of rape, incest, or danger to a woman's health. Okay, so without the financial means to travel out of state to one of the remaining four states where it was legal to have an abortion, which those at the time were Hawaii, Alaska, Washington, and New York, although in Hawaii, you had to be a resident to receive it. So even if she went to Hawaii, she couldn't get one.
Okay.
So because she couldn't afford to travel out of state to those states to get an abortion, she sought out an illegal abortion. So illegal, quote unquote, back alley abortions or self-induced abortions are extremely dangerous. And scholars estimate that around 20 to 25% of pregnancies ended in abortion before Roe v. Wade.
Wow, what?
Yes, you can't.
Really?
Yes, it's impossible to track this accurately because it was a crime. It was illegal at the time. But scholars who have looked into this is just their estimate that about a fourth of pregnancies ended in abortion during that time before Roe v. Wade. Like, let's go into what would a self-induced abortion or back alley abortion look like during that time. So some examples would include drinking chemicals such as turpentine, or rat poison, or various other things. And then also using clothes hangers, like the wire clothing hangers.
Oh, yeah.
Also, women would throw themselves downstairs.
Oh, my God.
And there's probably many more different methods, but these are the main examples that I found. So as you can see, this is not the safest procedure one could do on themselves. And so it is estimated that around 200 women would die each year during the process of trying to self-induce abortions or have a back alley one. And some women would try to find medical professionals who could safely perform the abortion, but again, this is done criminally and at great risk to the medical career of the professional. So McCorvey tries to get an illegal abortion through a back alley provider, but ends up being unsuccessful. So then, even though she can't get an abortion, she is then referred to Texas attorneys Linda Coffey and Sarah Weddington, who are interested in challenging anti-abortion laws. So in court documents, and to protect her identity, McCorvey then goes under a pseudonym, which a pseudonym is a fake name, of Jane Roe. So this is where we get the Roe in Roe v. Wade. And then the case begins in 1970 when the attorneys file a lawsuit on behalf of McCorvey and all other women who were or might become pregnant and want to consider all options against Henry Wade, who is the district attorney of Dallas County, Texas, where Roe resided. So that's where we get the Wade in Roe v. Wade. And then in June of that year, a Texas district court ruled that the state's abortion ban was illegal because it violated a constitutional right to privacy. So for those who are not familiar, the way Supreme Court cases arise is you'll usually take an issue to court locally or on the state level, and then that has a ruling, and then after that it can get brought up to the Supreme Court, so raised to the next level.
Like, you, like, petition for it to be reviewed by the Supreme Court, but they don't have to. Like, they can, they only choose a select few to review.
Yes. Yeah, okay, so on a district level, they ruled that it's illegal and she should be able to have an abortion. But afterward, Wade declared that he would continue to prosecute doctors who performed abortions, and then he also appeals the case up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And then during this time, McCorvey actually already gave birth and put the child up for adoption again, because you only have 9 months.
Yeah.
And then to set the stage while this is happening, the late 60s and early 70s were characterized by huge civil rights movements and some major court cases that had been heard and ruled upon recently during this time are Griswold versus Connecticut in 1965. Nat, do you know what this one is? Some trivia?
No, I don't know this one at all.
That's okay. We should review these. Anyone studying for the Foreign Service Officer Test, Supreme Court cases are very important. So, Griswold versus Connecticut is the Supreme Court case where they ruled that married people had the right to use contraception.
Wow, I didn't even... That's crazy that that's, like, a federally regulated. It's like, oh, yes, you have permission.
Yes!
But only for married people.
Exactly! It's only decided for married people. And this was based on the couple's right... a married couple's right to privacy. So 1965, married people have access to contraceptions. And then we get Einstein versus Baird in 1972, which is when the Supreme Court then extends that right to unmarried people, so singles. Now they have access to contraceptives. And the reasoning for that expansion was the court held that a distinction between single and married individuals fails to satisfy the, quote, rational basis test, unquote, of the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. So it's a fancy way of saying that your right to privacy is not distinguishable between you being single versus married. You always have a right to privacy.
Yeah, your marital status.
Exactly.
Also, like, how do you have to prove, like, do you have to bring your marriage certificate? Like, how would you prove that?
I do not know. We should ask our grandparents.
Show them, get a fake ring.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, sure.
I'm married. He proposed. Yeah. Anyways.
Okay, yeah, anyway.
Okay, so my favorite part of Supreme Court cases is what did each side say? I think it's the most important to hear out the arguments. So, arguments for Texas. Here we go. So, on the Texas side, on the Wade side, arguing that abortion should be illegal and the Texas law banning abortion is not unconstitutional, they argued that, firstly, there is no right to an abortion in the Constitution. And this is an important point that I want to mention because this is actually an argument that many people today will continue to use. And they state that the ruling of Roe v. Wade was invalid because our Constitution does not explicitly state it. The next thing is, there is nothing to suggest that the framers of the 14th Amendment intended to protect such a right. The 14th Amendment states, for anyone who has forgotten, it states that no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges of immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws.
Okay.
Okay. The Texas argument is that when they wrote that 14th Amendment, they didn't mean for it to mean abortion or include that issue.
Yeah.
And then even if the right is implicated, Texas law is supported by a compelling state interest in protecting human life, and they claim that life is a process that begins at conception.
Okay.
They also... Go ahead. Do you have points? I think it'll be more interesting if you say your points.
Yeah, like, I guess, because this whole time when you were, like, reading the 14th Amendment, I'm thinking about it from the pregnant woman's perspective, like, but then I guess other people are thinking about it from the perspective of the, like, unborn child, the fetus. Yeah.
Yes.
So that's where it gets tricky, because you were reading that, and I was like, oh, okay, well, yeah, but then now I guess it's, that's how people interpret it differently.
Yes. See, and it depends on when you believe life starts, right?
Yeah.
So that's the thing. And I'll probably mention it later, but I want to say, like, the court, in order to come to a solution, the court decides that it's not their responsibility to decide when life begins, whether that's at birth or whether that's during conception, that they need to instead just rule on the women's rights as an individual.
Okay, so, yeah, when the Supreme Court is debating this topic, so then they're, like, focusing on women's rights, they can't decide, they can't determine when life starts, so then that just means that they can't focus on fetus, right?
Well, like, no. So the thing is, we will get to the point later. I probably shouldn't have spoiled that.
Okay.
But when we get to it, it'll make more sense, kind of like how they decided to do a ruling. But the thing is, like, if you start debating over when life starts, there's not really a right answer to that. If you believe life starts at conception, that's what you believe. Mm-hmm. But not everyone believes that. And there's also no right answer. That's like a philosophical question.
That's true.
Anyways, so they claim that a fetus is a person with the meaning of the 14th Amendment. So permitting abortions is depriving a human of life.
Okay.
And then in the case of Griswold versus Connecticut, they state that the ruling protected marital privacy, not the right to choose an abortion, as abortions are performed in hospitals or clinics by strangers. And so this is a common occurrence, as well as that during Supreme Court hearings, you tend to draw off of previous rulings in other historical cases. So Griswold versus Connecticut is a case that comes up quite a lot.
Okay.
And then lastly, which this is like a cheap shot in my opinion, they argued that the challenger is moot, quote unquote moot. I don't know if that's like a lawyer term, which means that it has no relevance because she already gave birth. So they shouldn't even be arguing this case because it's not relevant anymore.
Yeah, I also see that it's like a cheap shot. Like, obviously, your pregnancy is going to move faster than the Supreme Court, than the legal system. Like,
yeah, exactly.
That's not fair.
Okay, so now that's what Texas's arguments were. That's what the Wade side was for. Now we're going to go for the arguments for Jane Roe. So, firstly, they say that the Texas law infringes upon an individual's right to privacy as recognized in Griswold. It is protected by the decision whether or not to bear a child, which is a liberty protected by the Due Process Clause, or an unenumerated right protected by the Ninth Amendment. So, the right to an abortion should be recognized as a fundamental right, triggering strict scrutiny because of the great impact childbearing and childbirth have on a woman's life. And as a refresher, strict scrutiny is a requirement that any state law that restricts fundamental constitutional rights has to be driven by a compelling state interest.
Okay. So they have to have a good reason, basically?
Yes.
Okay.
You have to have a very specific reason that is meant to further a state's interest in order to enforce a law that is going to restrict your fundamental rights.
Yeah, so basically, are they trying to get at, like, it can't be about morals, it has to be about specific legal...
Yeah, it has to be, like, a state interest, so...
Yeah.
I don't want to say, like, what a state interest would or would not be, but, like, their state interest is protecting fetal life.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, and so also, too, so Texas said that the reason the law was in place was to protect a woman's health, but actually, the Roe side addresses this by saying, regarding the risk to a woman's health at the time this court case was occurring, during the first trimester, a woman receiving an abortion has a death rate of 5 times less than the risk of dying from childbirth.
Wow.
I've never given childbirth, but I do know that it's very dangerous. Now we have a lot more technological and medical achievements.
Uh-huh.
So it's a lot safer for women, but it still is very, very dangerous to give birth. It's a very risky process, mm-hmm. and a lot can go wrong. So during the first trimester, if you receive an abortion, that process is actually 5 times less dangerous than giving childbirth.
Wow. That's really interesting.
Yes. I mean, I'm not surprised. Do you know how many things can happen to you when you're giving birth and pregnant? You can lose your hair. You can lose your teeth. You break ribs.
Oh.
Like, I was telling my mom this because I read a BuzzFeed article on all the things that women experienced while childbearing and giving birth. And I was telling my mom this. She said, yeah, you can die.
like that.
What?
Like hemorrhaging and like you just don't stop bleeding and
obviously my great grandparents is a whole different but my great grandma passed away from giving childbirth, you know?
Did she really?
Oh yes, God. Of course. Actually two of them. So okay, we don't need to go into my family history. But actually there's quite a few women in my family lineage lines that passed away from giving childbirth.
Oh my God. I need to ask my parents.
But that's in the 1800s. But still, the risk is real. So anyways, actually no, that's early 1900s. Okay, so in addition to that, unwanted pregnancies also disrupt life in areas of financial burden, psychological burden, physical experience of pregnancy and childbirth itself, and the social stigma of being an unwed mother.
Like, it's life-altering. Even if you choose adoption, you still have to go through a pregnancy, and that not even just like raising a child, but like pregnancy in of itself is
no joke.
Financially, like if you can't, depending on what your employment situation is, like if you can't do your job while pregnant, how are you supposed to support yourself?
Yes, and we're gonna get into it at the end because honestly I have so many just questions about this, because giving birth is not free, okay? Having medical appointments, going to the hospital, none of that's so for expensive. Free. So who's paying for it if you can't afford that?
And if you can't, like, work the same hours or work the same job you did before, like, on top of the medical bills.
Yeah, and, like, being pregnant is so... I don't know if you've ever had a headache or if anyone's listened to this. Mm. If you have, a pretty bad headache and you're trying to do your job, or if you're a bit sick and you're trying to do your job, it is so hard to do.
Yeah.
I struggle a lot with just headaches. Mm. I can't imagine morning sickness.
Yeah.
So, okay, and then continuing the argument against the Texas law is that the Texas law also violated the fundamental right of doctors to give medical care. And the Texas law is not supported by a compelling state interest, which for them, the interest was in protecting fetal life. And they said this is not compelling because fetuses have no rights under Texas law. So you can't say that you're interested in protecting fetal life because you don't recognize fetuses as humans. Mm. There are no rights addressing fetal life and their rights as individuals. Mm. And then they also say that the interest in protecting mother's health does not justify a total ban, only regulation to increase safety procedures. And then they also go on to state that fetuses are not quote-unquote persons with the meaning of the 14th Amendment, as abortions were legal and more common in 1868 than in 1973. Therefore, there could be no intent to make fetuses persons.
Wow. Interesting. Okay, yeah.
I think that's the strongest argument they have.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's what you said at the top of the episode, is that it didn't used to be illegal, and then it was illegal, but so then I guess if you're thinking about, like, what did the founding fathers intend, I mean, I guess that's kind of your answer right there.
And then they also say, like, persons elsewhere in the Constitution clearly refers to persons after birth, as they are not counted in the enumeration, which means census, clause.
Oh, wow. Okay. Wow. I would have never thought of that. That's a really good, that's a strong argument to make.
Yeah. And actually, so these two, Sarah Weddington and Linda Coffey, were actually both fairly new lawyers. They were like fairly young women at the time, fresh out of law school. So you can just tell that they're very passionate about this.
Yeah.
Because their points and their research are really well thought out. They're really covering all their bases.
Yeah. Definitely.
And then lastly, they address that argument from Texas about being moot. They say the law is not moot simply because Jane Roe is no longer pregnant, as the Supreme Court could not decide this case in less than 9 months. Mm-hmm. So it fits within exception for cases, quote, capable of repetition yet evading review, unquote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they said that they were representing pregnant women and women who want options. So the process will repeat itself. It wasn't a one-time occurrence. Like,
yeah. So in conclusion, the Roe side, Roe alleges that the state laws were unconstitutionally vague and abridged her right of personal privacy protected by the 1st, 4th, 5th, 9th, and 14th Amendments.
Mm. Wow. I'm just really glad you laid out the legal arguments so clearly, because I guess, like, oftentimes when we talk about abortion, it really, people mostly talk about social and like moral, ethical, religious issues, and so, like, most discussions about that, I don't really hear, like, the technical legal arguments for either side. So that was really nice.
Yeah.
Because that's what it boils down to. I mean, like, when we talk about the legal status of abortion in the U.S., that's what it is. It's, like, the legal status, not whether or not you agree with the procedure itself, but, like, whether the government has a right to legalize it or, like, yeah, you know, like make it illegal. Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
You know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah, I like when we take emotion out of it and literally just focus on the interpretation of the law, because that's how you win an argument, is using facts and using, yeah, convincing arguments. Mm-hmm. So, okay, now we hit the final ruling. So on January 22nd, 1973, the Supreme Court, in a 7-2 decision, struck down the Texas law banning abortion, effectively legalizing the procedure nationwide and rendering abortion bans unconstitutional.
Wow, I thought it would have been more, like, polarizing. I thought it would have been, like, 5-4, you know, like, 7-2, that's...
Nope, 7-2, because the Supreme Court is not supposed to be a political entity.
Yeah, that's true.
You didn't hear it from that's me. It's supposed to judge on the basis of law interpretation. Yeah. So, anyways, and the two that dissented were actually two newer judges on the Supreme Court. The Roe versus Wade had gone through a hearing, and then actually two Supreme Court justices passed away, and then these two ones came on board. Yeah, so that's why this court ruling got delayed a bit longer, too, is because they actually had two of them pass away, or retire. I don't know if they passed away or retired, but they weren't there anymore.
They left.
Justice Harry Blackmun of the court actually served as the head lawyer of the Mayo Clinic, which is a huge medical institution in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so he had a lot of experience with medical care and had quite a passion for this. So it was kind of appropriate that he would write the opinion on this. And he wrote that a woman's right to an abortion was implicit in the right to privacy protected by the 14th Amendment. In his opinion, Blackmun noted that only a compelling state interest justifies regulations limiting fundamental rights such as privacy, and that legislators must therefore draw statutes narrowly to express only the legitimate state interests at stake. Hmm. So their law is way too vague. Mm-hmm. If it was actually for a compelling state interest, that needs to be a very narrowly tailored law for that state interest. He also pulled off of arguments from Griswold versus Connecticut and said that privacy extends from contraception to abortion, because it's your right to decide whether or not you want to have children.
Yeah, I see the link.
Yeah. And he makes note of the understanding that maternity and motherhood can force upon the woman a distressful life in future. So, okay, like, a little excerpt from his statement is, a woman's right to choose to have an abortion falls within the right to privacy. A state law that broadly prohibits abortion without respect to the state of pregnancy or other interests violates that right. Although the state has legitimate interest in protecting the health of pregnant women and the potentiality of human life, the relative weight of each of these interests varies over the course of pregnancy, and the law must account for this variability. Mm. So that is their final ruling. However, the Supreme Court does disagree with Roe's assertion of an absolute right to terminate pregnancy in any way at any time. And so they do attempt to balance a woman's right to privacy with a state's interest in regulating abortion. This is the answer to our question. Mm-hmm. The court then divides pregnancy into three trimesters. So the first trimester, which is weeks 1 to 12, the decision is completely up to the woman and her doctor on whether or not she wants an abortion.
Yeah.
And then during the second trimester, which is weeks 12 to 24, this is where abortions can be a bit riskier, so states can then place limits on abortion, but not ban them outright. And then the third trimester, which is weeks 24 to 36, where abortions are the riskiest, the state can prohibit abortion to protect a fetus that could survive on its own outside the womb, except when a woman's health is in danger.
Okay.
So, like, with those laws, you have to define what viability means. So, with regard to the fetus, the court located the point of viability or a capability of meaningful life outside the mother's womb to around 24 weeks of pregnancy.
Okay.
That's the conclusion they get to. So that's the answer to our question on what, as of today, women's rights are for an abortion. It's broken down into trimesters. Yeah.
Okay.
And then the dissenting opinion, which that was written by Justice William H. Rehnquist, and he argued that the framers of the 14th Amendment did not intend for it to protect the right to privacy, which is a right which they did not recognize, and that they definitely did not intend for it to protect a woman's decision to have an abortion. So that's his point. Okay, now we're going to go into life after the ruling and current events going on surrounding the ruling. So as soon as Roe v. Wade passed, various states have created different laws to get around Roe v. Wade and make receiving an abortion extremely difficult for women. Mm. So an example of this is there was another Supreme Court case called Casey versus Planned Parenthood in 1992, and that was a court case involving restrictions placed by a state to make abortion harder for women to get. And we can cover that in another episode, but that's all you need to know is there's a whole another hearing on it.
Yeah.
Most recently, on December 1st of 2021, there was a hearing on the Dobbs versus Jackson Supreme Court case. And this is one of the most directly challenging cases to Roe v. Wade that we've had in recent years. To summarize that case, what's up for debate is a Mississippi law that was put in place that reduces the week of viability from 24 weeks to 15. And we don't expect a ruling on the case of Dobbs versus Jackson until June or July this year, but that's something you should pay attention to. And then, so in November, also of 2021, the Supreme Court had a hearing on a Texas law called the SB 8 law, which permits any private citizen in Texas or elsewhere to sue anyone who performs an abortion in the state after an embryo's cardiac activity has started, which actually is, it's also known as like a heartbeat bill when we're talking about.
Oh, okay.
And this is actually, this is a result of electrical activity within the cells. And that occurs around 5.5 to 6 weeks of pregnancy.
Oh,
it's very early. It's actually earlier than when many women realize that they're even pregnant.
Yeah, that's what I was just about to say. Some people don't even know they're pregnant yet.
Right, yeah, because most people, just on average, most women realize they're pregnant around 4 to 7 weeks.
Yeah.
This law makes it really hard. And
yeah.
In addition, I mean, like, if you realize you're pregnant at week 5, and then you have till week 6 to make a decision. 1 week to make a decision is not enough time, I think.
Not to mention that, like, access to clinics that perform abortions is very, very, very limited in, like, certain areas of the U.S. Like, that you have to drive hours to get to a clinic. And, like, if you don't, what if you don't have the transportation to get there or you can't take time off work to get there? Like, then you miss the legal deadline and then... Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. I didn't even consider that, but you're right. Yeah.
But anyway.
Okay. So, you know, these are just state laws. Right. And the thing is, too, if you go with the interpretation of that, they're not banning abortion, but they're allowing people to sue. So it's a way of getting around the federal law, because technically the federal law, Roe v. Wade, does not state that they can't, you can't sue. It's not saying you can't get an abortion, but they're making it nearly impossible for you to find a provider who's willing to do that. It's a very short window to make a decision for pregnant women. So those are kind of what's been happening in the news surrounding Roe v. Wade. And then also many pro-choice activists have a lot of concern over the Supreme Court. So anyone who's outside of the United States listening to us, we're just going to break down how the U.S. Supreme Court works. And we have 9 justices or judges who are appointed directly by the U.S. president at that time. And these justices will serve for life or until they choose to retire. So today, the Supreme Court is comprised of a 6-3 conservative majority, which means 6 justices are with the conservative party, which tend to be more pro-life, and 3 are liberal, and they tend to be more pro-choice. So many people are concerned that Roe v. Wade will actually be fully overturned, as they only need a 5-4 majority to do it. And so with this new 6-3 majority, a lot of pro-life activists are very excited about the opportunity to overturn the ruling, hence why we are starting to see an increase in these abortion laws, which is leading to Supreme Court hearings on them. So if Roe v. Wade does get overturned, several states do have what are known as trigger laws. This means that if the ruling of the Supreme Court does overturn Roe v. Wade, then they would immediately ban abortion. And these states are Kentucky, Tennessee, Arkansas, Louisiana, Missouri, Texas, North and South Dakota, Idaho, and Utah. And it's not clear whether they have exceptions for rape or incest.
Wait, so, okay, I'm sorry. These trigger laws, so it's just like they're like prepared, like they're just ready to go, like on standby just in case.
Yes, they're just on the book. So once, if the federal law does get overturned, then those will automatically be in place in the state.
Mm-hmm. Wow, I didn't know you could do that with, wow, okay, interesting.
The more you know. Wow. And then other states such as Ohio have similar quote-unquote heartbeat bills that we saw in Texas on the books as well that will restrict or increase the difficulty of a woman to receive an abortion. So those are also on standby. And these laws, of course, will most greatly affect the poorest women of our country mm-hmm. who do not have the ability to travel elsewhere to receive an abortion. So those are just some facts. I'm trying to present this as unbiased as possible.
Yeah.
And as a closing, I just want to say the reason that this is so polarizing is because there's a huge range of gray space mm-hmm. on when and if the government should intervene or if they should intervene at all.
Yeah.
And like we talked about, I'm personally just left with a lot of questions on this. And if abortion does become illegal, what are the economic implications of women being forced to carry children to term? What impact does that have on our adoption system, foster care system? Is our welfare system large enough to handle an influx in unwanted births? Are contraceptives readily available? What is the impact of women in the workforce? Will the expenses of giving birth be completely covered by the state? And so forth. Lots and lots and lots.
Wow.
But my main closing thought is that whether you are pro-life, pro-choice, man, woman, non-binary, wealthy, poor, you should be paying attention to this because it is going to affect all of us. There are going to be impacts on all of our systems from housing, employment, economics, and healthcare whenever population increases. And the only guarantee as abortion laws change is that birth rates will also change.
Wow. I never even considered any other aspect except for, like, women's rights. Wow. Jack, you gave us a lot of questions to think about and reflect on. Because, yeah, I guess the topic of abortion can get really emotional and really heated. And people can really single in on one certain aspect. But I think, Jack, that's really good that you pointed out every aspect that a change would result in. So thank you so much for doing such an amazing job covering the legal arguments and limitations of this law. And I learned so much. And now, you're right, now I'm left with many more questions, which is good to reflect on. So what a great way to start off the new year. And thank you to all of our listeners for continuing to support us. We hope you guys have a great new year.
Yes, thanks so much, everyone. Bye.
This has been an episode of How Did We Not Know That?
If you liked it, don't forget to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.
You can also follow us on all social media at HDWNKT and subscribe to our YouTube channel.
Also, check out our website at hdwnkt.com to find all of our show notes and study guides for each episode.
You can help us improve the quality of the podcast by becoming a history hero through our Patreon.
Thank you for listening and see you guys next week.